Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're still in the first hour of this live broadcast. Thank you so much for rejoining us on the live stream here on TNT, today's News Talk. Appreciate you guys, especially everybody in the TNT chat room. We see some good community, thriving community, a lot of good opposition research in there as well. Appreciate the links, everybody. I'll be interacting with you shortly, later in the hour. But I want to welcome, to the show, a very special guest, among other things. He is an investigative journalist. He's also an adept historian as well. He's joining us on the line. His name is Tony Gosling. You will be familiar with his work, especially if you live in, you're around the United Kingdom. Tony, thank you for joining us on TNT this week.
No problem. Thanks very much for asking me, Patrick. And, you know, I know we like to point fingers at the mainstream press, but every now and again they come up with some real goodies. And, you know, you won't believe what I'm saying here, but it is Channel 4, Channel 4 News this week, done an exclusive investigation into the 2019 bombings, which killed about 200 people in Sri Lanka. And they've done a super job on it. Now, you know, the irony here is, of course, that they wouldn't do the same sort of work on a domestic bombing here in the UK or in the United States. They just simply wouldn't bother because it's the wrong story. But what they've revealed is that the Rajapaksas in Sri Lanka were intimately involved in the, at least the government, that they were trying to get, they were trying to get themselves re-elected. In these bombings themselves, and there were liaisons between the government, between the military, and the so-called bombers. Now, I mean, the hideous thing about it is that they targeted churches in Sri Lanka, and you know, like I say, a couple of hundred people were killed. And so, and these were, you know, particularly important religious services around Easter time. So. The idea, I think, here is pretty obvious. What they're trying to do is basically ride to an election victory. The Rajapaksas, of course, have been since booted out by other means, but I shouldn't laugh, but this is the way the world works, I'm afraid. And that they were trying to get themselves elected, saying, look, you know, we've had these terrible bombings and, you know, we're the strong guys, we're the strong people, we will make sure you're protected. And of course, they did actually win that election. So I think we need to be really, you know, careful and understanding of the fact that terrorist attacks, false flag terrorist attacks carried out by our own leaders, rulers, can be used as an election tool, as a kind of, I mean, we all know about Russiagate and election fixing, the so-called accused, you know, is accused in the United States, for example. But the idea of a government just blowing up some of its own people and saying, hey, guys, you know, we're the strong ones, and trying to get a vote, and in Sri Lanka's case, succeeding as a result of that. So, you know, I don't often say it, but Channel 4 News have done a good job, and it's a dispatches film that's well worth watching.
That's interesting, Tony. Like, if you take away the number of casualties, or, you know, the type of the method of the operation and so forth, and look at the political outcome, the motivations, that template, that formula, which you just laid out, which is as an election, coercive tool to move public opinion in a direction of a certain party or a certain candidate or whatever, that formula actually works. And that's the point. But people would get confused because they would say they'd expect the same type of operation to happen in Britain or France, and it wouldn't be true. It'd be a different operation, but the formula is the same, right?
You're right. Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the 2017 general election in the UK, which was a snap election called by Conservative leader Theresa May, she thought that, I mean, she's pretty dim, really. I mean, it was her husband that is the very wealthy one that seemed to be really running the show. And that election in 2017 was called at the last minute, and no one was really expecting it. But what happened in the run-up, in the few weeks before it, as I'm sure you know, is we had a Manchester Arena terrorist attack, we had the London Bridge terrorist attack, and we had the Westminster Bridge terrorist attack, where some guy rammed his car into the gates of Parliament. So, you know, looking at those sorts of attacks, it's a bit strange that they were all just happening just in the few weeks before that general election. But then if you look at the way that the press was spinning the Jeremy Corbyn angle, you'll see why. It's because in that final week, like literally 1 week before the general election and the six days before, there was a running story all about Jeremy Corbyn. He's here. He is standing with terrorists, and there's pictures of him with, I think they were Hezbollah leaders or something. But the idea really is to create this, really to dominate, you know, the few weeks before the general election with this terrorist agenda. I think that's exactly what happened in 2017 with Jeremy Corbyn being basically fitted up as a terrorist after these three serious terrorist attacks. The one thing that those three attacks had in common, though, Patrick, and I don't know if you picked up on this, you may well have done at the time, was that in the immediate aftermath, the press reports. So as a plane just taking off behind me, in the immediate aftermath of the press reports, we were told that each of these people, the individuals behind these attacks, including supposedly Salman Abedi, the alleged Manchester bomber, I don't necessarily believe he was really behind it, but leave that aside, had all been reported to MI5 via the anti-terrorist hotline. So the people who carried these attacks had already been flagged up by members of the public to the security services, and yet the security services had obviously, you know, not done their job at all. In fact, maybe those phone calls were to put somebody on to thinking, well, this would make a good patsy, this guy would make a good terrorist. One of the guys in those terrorist attacks before the 2017 general election in the UK had even been on a Channel 4 documentary.
Yes.
As a jihadi, you know.
Kareem Butt? Was that his name?
That's the one.
Yes.
You got him.
Right.
But see, this is, I think what we're seeing is a kind of form of theatre in a way. So somebody is saying, well, look, how on earth are we going to stop Jeremy Corbyn getting elected? Well, let's set him up as a terrorist. How do you do that? Okay, well, let's have a few terrorist attacks. And then let's have, just in a few days before the actual vote itself, let's have loads of pictures of Jeremy Corbyn with one of these people in an organization that's now been proscribed as a terror organization. So anyway, I mean, you know, all I'm trying to do, I suppose, is redress the balance a bit, where Channel 4 are pointing the finger at Sri Lanka, saying, you do this stuff. What I'm saying is we do it too.
Yeah. By the way, that is a World War II. That's a vintage fighter jet. Is that what's flying over?
It's not a jet. No. It's an Merlin engine. I'm actually up at the Duxford where they're getting ready for an air display in a couple of weeks' time up here, a Battle of Britain air display where they do a sort of fake, fake fighting in the sky. We hope nothing. And it is that, you know, one of the lovely things about here, and all the visitors are saying the same, is that you've actually got rather than you sitting at looking at an aeroplane in a hangar doing nothing, you know, sitting around, looking a bit embarrassed to be not up in the air. They've got a lot of flying aircraft here too.
Yeah, no, they are loud too. And it just makes you think, sorry, we're getting off slightly on a bird walk here, but back in those days, Tony, when those plane squadrons were coming, you could hear it, and you could hear it from a distance. There's a really specific sound, wasn't it? The signature of that.
Well, I wasn't around for it, but one thing I can tell you is that when the Blitz in London began in 1940, the man who was responsible for it was the former king, Edward VIII, because he'd been down in Lisbon chatting to the German ambassador to Portugal down there, and saying, well, you need to start bombing London in order to force the British to the negotiating table. And guess what? A week later or so, the German bombers started dropping bombs on London and the Blitz began.
Oh, well, that's an interesting segue in history I'd like to explore. But quickly back to the false flag story. So was it Wreathgate? Was it Jeremy Corbyn laying a wreath at the graves of what they call Palestinian terrorists?
That's one. I mean, that was the main one. Yeah, but there were other accusations of Corbyn, you know, basically fraternizing with terrorists. So, I mean, you know, you had the same exact thing with Ken Livingstone, who was the mayor of London in the 1980s, having talks with the IRA, or Sinn Féin, actually, not the IRA, the political wing of the IRA, saying, well, look, you know, the only way to end the war in Northern Ireland is to have political dialogue. And of course, he was absolutely right to do that, just as we should be having dialogue with the Russians. Now Boris Johnson, you know, has put pay to all that, making sure that that there was no agreement in Ukraine. So, you know, there has to be discussion, there has to be dialogue on a political level in order to stop these conflicts. The same as the conflict between the Saudis and the Yemenis, which is still rumbling on. It's not as intense as it was, but these things are absolutely crucial, these diplomatic ties.
No, you're absolutely correct to point this out. And the timing of what you're lining that up with Corbyn, there was an absolute campaign, as you said, Tony, to basically smear Corbyn as a pro-everything terrorist and Russian agent and everything else in between. And then all of those events happening in succession. And there was really a whole slew of events. There was also the London Bridge Farrago. There was the one, I think it was Blackfriars Bridge, where a guy came with a mastodon tusk or something, and the guys had knives duct taped to his kitchen knives duct taped to his hands. I mean, all these improbable attacks. The Parsons Green, bomb wasn't a bomb. It was like a chapati flour bomb. I don't know what it was, but there was all of this drama, all of these theatrics, Tony, and looking back on them, they look ridiculous. They really do. But at the moment, Tony, the media hype was there, and the seriousness was there. Theresa May was strong and stable. It was all happening. It is incredible, and I think you've got you have a very compelling thesis or hypothesis and thesis.
Well, thanks, but we've just had literally yesterday the news that this guy Daniel Asid Khalif in Britain has escaped. He was a British Army soldier who's been charged under the Official Secrets Act. They're very vague about what he was being charged with, but clearly the British forces believe that they caught him using confidential army information that may be used against the British forces, and he was under arrest. Well, he managed to escape. So you do wonder what on earth is going on with Julian Assange. This guy has managed to hop out of Wandsworth prison. Apparently he hung on underneath a bus in order to get out of the prison, and yet someone like Julian Assange, who is just like you and I, investigative journalist, editor of various platforms, alternative news platforms or whatever, and for example, you know, he has led, Julian that is, has led to, I recently absolutely bottomed out the story that the Icelandic bankers were jailed because of WikiLeaks, because of documents that were used by the prosecution which were published on WikiLeaks. And so it seems to me incredible and insane and diabolical that this guy, Julian Assange, who is just someone like you and I, as a journalist, he's been jailed for doing his job, is being kept in this high security prison, while somebody who's potentially an extremely dangerous trained soldier, using allegedly anyway his abilities against the British forces, is just allowed to escape by hanging underneath a bus. You have to wonder whether he maybe had some help to escape from somebody else, from the Foreign Intelligence Service or whoever, but the whole thing story is fantastic. And you know what? I think it's one of the most important places in history. And I think, you know, even in 100 years' time, people will be looking back and going, "Good God, that Julian Assange case!" You know, and then no one will be quite believing that the British could do such an appalling thing. And you know, it's nice to see that there are this cross-party group of Australian MPs now heading over to the United States to, you know, put the case for Julian to the Americans at the highest possible level.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, and he's been kept on ice by the British government for the Americans, and you know, it'd be very convenient if he was have serious health problems, or God forbid, was, you know, not to survive Belmarsh prison. That would just, you know, absolve everybody, wouldn't it, of any responsibility. They'd probably canonize him as a hero at that point, the establishment, because it would be safe to do so, and lament his maybe unfortunate and maybe unjust incarceration. You know how they usually rework the PR, Tony?
Oh, yeah. After the fact. Of course. It's so irritating. marketing. And the fact is that what they were doing with WikiLeaks was really shaming and embarrassing all of the billions that spent in the London media, you know, by these Sky, you know, wherever they are, BBC, Sky, ITV, Channel 4, all the rest of them, you know, have been completely shamed by the gutsy reporting from WikiLeaks. And I mean, they would probably, if Julian was around now, he would have been. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this stuff about the Californian biolabs that Fox News have been publishing the last week or so. I mean, it's absolutely incredible that you've got secret Chinese, joint Chinese, US Pentagon funded biolabs in California still. So, I mean, it's good to see that there are still some mainstream, you know, and I, as someone who worked in the mainstream myself, I know it can be really difficult, but there are, and it does seem to me that it's the Murdoch empire that's pushing out most of the really good and useful stuff. Obviously, Channel 4, we were talking about earlier. But literally just sitting down here in Ducks, I hope you don't mind me talking about it. I was been sitting here with some old timers, British old timers, chatting at Duxford about the war. And one of the guys said, well, of course, what you can't say is who won the war, you know, after World War II. And, you know, that this is the biggie, isn't it? Because the Germans did a lot better industrially, et cetera, than the Brits after the war. In fact, the book I wrote, this is 3 years ago and published during the lockdown. I was so annoyed with that Halloween lockdown. I thought, I'm going to end my battle with this publisher who commissioned the book to get it published. And I'm just going to publish it myself during the lockdown. And it's called The Traitors of Arnhem. It's about the deals which were being done between Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, who's a fascinating character in himself. He was the guy behind the Zinoviev letter, which lost Labour one of the elections between the wars. And he was the head of economic warfare between the wars as well. He was the aide-de-camp to General Haig in World War One. And Morton was Churchill's private secretary during World War II, and he was doing deals behind the scenes with Adolf Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, as early as 1944, I know about, and I document this. And those deals were basically to do deals between leading Nazis who had access to funds and to make sure that they were given safe passage after the war in exchange for vast quantities of money. And most of the Nazi loot was laundered through the Dulles brothers law firm Sullivan and Cromwell in New York, as many people have speculated, but it's nice to know for sure where this money actually did go. And then it was used by Bormann, who was rescued by the Brits at the end of the Second World War and then squirreled away in South America and Paraguay and Argentina. And, you know, they used to keep the people on the border. So if one country started to move against them, a legal system, then they could just hop over the river and they were in another country. And the 750 companies that he created from, he was a bit of a bureaucrat, a sort of mafia bureaucrat, Bormann, and then this money was injected into these firms, big multinationals, some of them became, and the crucial thing to understand is that Bormann put Jews in charge of many of these companies on purpose to disguise the fact that it was laundered Nazi money that had funded them. And so anyway, my book documents that, and it also looks at the Battle of Arnhem in World War II, which what that was really about was about buying time. I mean, it was a battle which was deliberately thrown by a couple of the top British generals, Boy Browning, one of them, and some others. And when they threw the battle, of course, the Germans won. In fact, Patrick, it's just coming up time for the anniversary for the Arnhem Battle. And if you're in that part of the world, you'll find a massive celebration going on, which is rather disgusting. A lot of the Dutch citizens that live around Arnhem, the site of this World War II battle, the Bridge Too Far battle, they kind of, you know, disappear because it's seen as it's basically a big celebration, a big party for a Nazi victory. So a lot of people in Holland just think, no, we don't really like this. Let's just go, maybe even go away from town for a few days. And so I make the connection between the Bilderberg conferences, which started in Oosterbeek, which is where the British were in World War II in that battle, being massacred in what they called the Witch Cauldron. And I make that link because this brought the Nazi, the failure of that battle that bought the Nazis an extra 3 or 4 months to squirrel their wealth away, to be used by Morton and Bormann later to create this kind of financial Fourth Reich. And I think a lot of the problems we're seeing in the world today, that's kind of what we're dealing with, really.
Yeah, that was really the beginning of this sort of modern transnational corporate, you know, networking. Was really some of those leading German industrial companies. They formed the sort of the backbone, if you will, of the sort of the post World War II transnational corporate European, the European branch, you could say, of the transnational corporate empire. And it's incredible. And a lot of those companies are still trading today. They still
absolutely right.
They
yeah.
didn't miss a step.
I mean, it's a cartel system. I mean, it was a cartel system that was brought in with people like Krupps and Thyssen, IG Farben, you know, the big steel companies that funded the early days of the Nazi Party. And I think that's what we're dealing with mostly today, is a cartel system where, you know, the big firms are all working very close. I mean, look at the oil business, you know, where they all work very, very closely together. And they all each have their own little patch. I mean, it's like the mafia dividing up their cities. You know, this is your patch, this is my patch, and that they do price fixing. We're seeing this all the time now in the UK with not just with fuel, with things like water, electricity, gas. Price fixing is just funnels that money into the pockets of shareholders. And really, all of these basic utilities, gas, water, all that stuff, after the war, they understood in Britain very, very well, you provide this stuff at cost, you know, basically water at cost, electricity at cost, transport, you know, public transport, whatever, getting around, fuel, that sort of thing at cost. And then the country can get on and actually produce stuff, make money. You know, small people can start in small businesses. But we're in a cartel network now with, you know, you're basically, which is being dominated by your Amazons, Patrick, I think, and people like that, these massive multinationals that have made sure that it's very, very difficult for ordinary entrepreneurs, ordinary families to get started in any kind of business, except maybe, you know, if you want to start a burger van, you know, that's fine. You can get on and do a burger van.
but don't get any ideas, anything
that might be innovative and challenge these cartels.
Yeah, cartels is the operative word there, Tony. Price fixing, business fixing, market fixing, cartels. The book is Traders of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group Origins by Tony Gosling. We dropped a link to that in the chat room there. Is that that was the book you're referring to?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it's the thing is, I met some people. I mean, I couldn't have done this on my own. It's just because I had the Bilderberg.org website. I had various people get in touch with me over the years who had really important bits of the jigsaw, such as a guy called Barry Wynn, who was in the SAS after the war in Malaya, etc. Brilliant guy. He was in ABC television as well. He was one of their, he was their chief publicity guy for the Avengers, the old black and white Avengers series. And Barry explained to me that he met this guy, Colonel Pinto, who's an intelligence officer in the Second World War, and he had lunch with him. And he took him through the whole story of how Prince Bernhard and others made sure that the Nazis knew that all these paratroopers were coming in Operation Market Garden. And he was just about to arrest this particular spy. And then he found out the next day, oh, no, he's been sent in, you know, by Bernhard, sent into Holland. And so he just about managed to slip under Pinto's radar. But then he went straight to the Abwehr as soon as this guy that they thought was working for the Dutch and the British and the Allies went straight to the Abwehr in Eindhoven and handed over all the information that they needed to know about the coming airdrop, which, by the way, I think it's still the biggest airborne invasion operation in history. I mean, it was over 3 days. They dropped 3 divisions of paratroopers, the 82nd Airborne, the 1st Airborne, and the 1st Airborne Division of Arnhem. And that's all documented. And I couldn't have done it without help from these other various fascinating characters who come to me over the years with these key bits of evidence. And of course, the link to the Bilderberg is really important, that this was really an in-joke. you know, so they met in the same place as the British were massacred by traitors within the British forces, and to buy time to create a Fourth Reich after the war, because they needed a few extra months. If that operation had succeeded, the British would have been into the Ruhr. It would have caused absolute chaos for the supply lines of the Germans in the Second World War. And the people were saying at the time that the war might have been over by Christmas 1944. But no, it went on another three, four months. Anyway,
we'll,
so
we'll talk about that Reich. It might be the Reich based in Brussels, Tony, but let's take a quick break. I want to get your opinion on that, and also to talk about your other book, which came out in 2022. But we'll talk about that and more after the break. I'm with investigative journalist Tony Gosling here live on TNT Today's News Talk. We'll be right back after these messages.
Political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're still in the first hour of this live broadcast. Great to have you, everybody. On the line with us right now is investigative journalist Tony Gosling, who is talking to us from a, what looks like a historic air show happening somewhere in the UK. Tony, we've still got you. I hear the Spitfires and the Messerschmitts above.
Actually, no, that is just a Piper Cub. I think a little single engine light aircraft revving up over in the background there. Nothing so exotic as a Spitfire or Hurricane right now.
Tony, is it your opinion that the Fourth Reich is based in Brussels? Was that the vision of Nazi Germany, a united Europe with Germany and?
Well, it includes the United States, I would say. I mean, it's kind of the Anglo-Zionist Empire and Israel. The Anglo-Zionist Empire we're looking at, as far as I can tell. But I think, you know, what there seems to be is a kind of a mafia operation in the West completely. So the idea is that there isn't really any regulation, that the success is based on who your friends are and what through personal contacts. So if you're not in the clique, then you're out the clique. And so that's, I think, the way it really works. But it's most definitely, yeah, I mean, Brussels is the headquarters in Europe, and NATO sitting there too, with their amazing building, which if you look at it from above, looks like the letters SS twice. You know, I don't know if you've seen the picture of it, but it's amazing. You know, it's the four Sigruns. I mean, obviously the United States is very much involved in all of this, and many of these corporations, I think, are based in the US. So the governments, I mean, this brings me on to another story from the UK. I'm not sure if people in other parts of the world have heard about this, but one of our main cities, Birmingham, has just announced that it's gone bankrupt. So they've actually run out of money to produce what is basic statutory services. So there are the services that a local authority has to provide, for example, education, things like this. They just haven't got the money for it anymore. The reason for that, and it's there are actually, I was reading earlier on, 26 different cities in Britain which are facing bankruptcy. The reason for all of this is really this is the fallout from 2008, from the bailouts, because it was in 2010 when the Conservative government with David Cameron and the coalition government was elected. One of the first things they did was to start the process of giving less money from the centre to local authorities. This is something, by the way, that the Kiev government was doing too. So, you know, the tax is all collected in the centre and then distributed around the country because obviously it's the people's money. No, that's all changed. And so since really, I'm just racking my brains to think exactly, it would be about 2015, 2017, there was an announcement by the then Conservatives, but that they would stop, or they would slowly be every year giving less money to local government. And it's now those chickens have come home to roost, and Birmingham Council has actually gone bankrupt. So the fact of the matter is these big corporations, cartels, as I was talking about earlier on, they're absolutely in the driving seat. They many of them pay no tax at all. We're now in the situation with the things like the ULEZ in London and the clean air zones in other parts of the country that people have got to pay just literally to get from one part of town to another. A 5-minute drive is going to cost you, what is it, £12 or something. So ordinary people and poor people are being taxed. And yet the super rich are being taxed nothing, and the big corporations aren't being taxed nothing too. So it's a really perverse, upside down situation developing.
So, and they're just passing
that's
cost.
That's what I see.
They're just passing the cost off to the consumer, right? That's what all businesses are going to do. So you just pay more for the product, right?
Exactly. I mean, they are becoming businesses, aren't they? And you know, I if you sit and think about it, it's pretty perverse that if you are super rich. Well, you don't even have to be super rich, do you? If you buy around about £10,000 to £15,000 worth of electricity or water shares, your dividends pay your bill, so you pay nothing. And who is paying those dividends? Well, that's the poorer people who are, need electricity, that need water, that need to use that utility. They're paying for your electricity as a someone who's got that money to invest in the business, and this was really, I suppose, started by Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s in the UK. So first thing she did, I laugh, but I shouldn't laugh. It's so tragic. The first thing she did when she got in 1979 was she got rid of exchange controls. So what did that mean? Well, that meant that every industry that she privatized, whether it be the ports, the airports, the water, the gas, the electricity, whatever it was that we used to own, BP, by the way, we had a controlling share in BP as well, in the British government did, that foreign companies can buy that up. That's what it means if you get rid of exchange control. So every one of those privatized businesses was so slowly bought up by foreign interests. And that's how you destroy national sovereignty. And I think that's what's been happening here in Britain, Patrick.
And Tony, do you address some of these issues in your book, The Siege of Heaven, how breaking the grip of oligarchy will unleash the world's human potential? This was published April 2022. This book came out, and you cover some of these issues, don't you?
Yeah, I certainly do. Which one are you talking about? Because there were two Siege of Heaven books, though. I did one which is called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is an anthology, which is also a paperback book. That Siege of Heaven is just really well, I say just, but it's a lot of scribblings, a lot of ideas, a lot of writings about these sorts of things, plus all the articles I did, or many of them, the ones I did for RT, when I had an RT column, and various other articles I've done since. I mean, for example, I did a look at I've done several quite big investigations, including that one I told you about to do with the Battle of Arnhem and the Bilderbergers and the Fourth Reich. But I've also done an investigation to the railways in Britain, the way that they were closed down in the 1960s by the oil companies, by the Americans, basically, and various other. I did one into the Freemasons, but there are two books. One is an e-book, which is called The Siege of Heaven, and there's another one, which is a paperback book too, which is The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is an anthology looking at, I mean, what I've done is I've pulled out a whole load of extracts from, all sorts of literature, and include some of them I actually sat and typed up because they were only in audio. They weren't actually published anywhere, so I typed them up. I'm not the fastest typist, but it's there. For example, Madeleine Brown, an interview with her, who was the girlfriend of Lyndon Johnson, who was in Dallas the night of the JFK assassination, and she testified as well. Yeah, Lyndon Johnson said to me, those Kennedys will never trouble me again. And all this, you know, there's all sorts of evidence in there of secret government. This is the Siege of Heaven Reader book with the little newborn baby with a cow tag in its ear, which I thought was a particularly powerful image, because that's where we're heading with all this, you know. And, you know, look at ULEZ, this mass surveillance. People just think, oh, yeah, mass surveillance. Well, I've done nothing wrong. Mass surveillance is exactly what was needed before the Holocaust, and the way that the Nazis and the SS were out, and the Gestapo rounded up Jews in a particular town for concentration camps, labor camps, etc., was using surveillance. They'd been, you know, they had computer databases which were you know, these old punch card Hollerith machines supplied by IBM in the 1930s. And that's how they did it. And so we need to be extremely wary of these, all these various sorts of surveillance systems. And ULEZ is just another one of those. It's tracking you everywhere you go in your car. A very, very powerful way of, if someone wanted to use that against you, well, maybe someone's going to sell them the information about where you are. Oh, you're not at home, so let's go and, you know, break into your house. This sort of thing is actually, you know, the bread and butter of these sort of surveillance systems, and why, you know, we've got data protection laws to try and stop these sort of things going on. But I mean, the other thing about ULEZ in London, which is this new London-wide, £12 a day you've got to pay if you've got a diesel car, and you know, and if you get a brand new Chelsea tractor, you don't pay anything. It's actually a system which has been totally developed technically by Siemens. Siemens was the big electronics company, Nazi electronics company. It was Nazified, actually, with big pictures of Adolf down the walls in World War II. So that those are the people that have developed this system. You don't need to be a genius to work out what they're going to use it for.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And again, yeah, the legacy, the heritage, the pedigree of the Nazi corporate network, it endures to this day. I'd love to talk about this, but also I want to talk more. Hopefully we can actually have a conversation again, there's a great book out. You've probably seen by, Asa Winstanley, The Weaponization of Anti-Semitism. It's just come out, and, I'm going to do a review on it. But it's definitely something, I think it speaks to a lot of things that you've talked about with the attack on Corbyn and other similar issues. But there's a lot of it is an interesting time, Tony. There's a lot of interesting material coming out right now. Yeah, so we're in a little.
Well,
bit,
that's why this is. I don't know if you've also seen Tony Greenstein's book, Zionism During the Holocaust, which is another. You know, this stuff is coming out. If people actually still read, I mean, the idea is, I suppose, to distract us and keep us busy so we don't pick up a book and read it. But if you do, with some of these sorts of things that we're discussing here, Patrick, you can actually, I think, stay ahead of the curve, because although a lot of this stuff is depressing, I have a very, very positive attitude to it all, because I think that you cannot run society, you know, they've tried it before, these control freaks, you cannot run society with a tiny number of, authoritarians trying to direct everything, because humanity, the human spirit, and it will always fight back and will always win. And the other thing is that they've taken on their own domestic populations in Europe and America, the West have, through many of these measures, like the zero carbon measures, etc. And they're also trying to take on Putin too. They can't possibly win.
Yeah, they got their hands full. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, and also check out Tony's work. Also, Tony's show as well is a fountain of knowledge that you want to be tuning into. We'll drop a link to that as well into the TNT chat community. Tony, thank you for joining us this week.
Thanks very much for asking me, Patrick. God bless.
We'll speak to you again soon, we hope. Safety in your travels. And we're going to go to the top of the hour news headlines right now.